I really wasn't sure how to do it. Like, how do you actually leave this culture that's been a part of your life your whole life? I just couldn't envision the practicalities of that.
For me, it was a real grieving process.
I almost view this like an act of a good Samaritan, helping people down a path that can be really painful and helping them figure out how to make it through.
I found this community, and I found a space that's normalized my experience.
There are a lot of people who have been down this path before you. There will be a lot of people coming after you, and it's okay.
There is a light at the other end.
We are not intending to talk anyone out of the church. This is for people who've already decided they've left. This is for the wardless.
You're listening to Wardless, a post-Mormon field guide, a podcast addressing the challenges and practicalities of navigating life after Mormonism, because leaving the church can be a little bit peculiar. Join us as we explore the path away from Mormonism and examine what it means to be wardless.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Wardless Podcast. My name is Oliver, and I will be moderating today's discussion, and I am joined in a bit of a first by an entire panel of guests. We do not have any of our regular panel today, and when we talk about the topic in just a minute, you'll understand why, but I am super excited today to have with us Dave.
Hi.
Miles.
Hello.
And Doug.
Hi.
Welcome the three of you to the Wardless Podcast and to our panel. Before we get started, we do have one housekeeping item. Our biggest struggle as the Wardless Podcast and as being a field guide for people who are walking away from Mormonism, and many times the hardest thing for us to do is find the people who are in the private, quiet struggle of figuring out how to walk away from Mormonism without being public about anything. One of the best things that you can do to help us is share our links with folks that you know going through this. The other thing you can do is go to Apple Podcasts and rate us. It's a one click of the button. It really helps us get discovered by people. So that is our housekeeping item for today. Well, it is really great to have you guys here and really appreciate you making the time to come and join us. So today is an interesting topic. For a while, we've been talking about as a podcast group that we wanted to have an episode about men. Like it was just called like the men episode in our content plan for a long time. Like we need a man episode. You know, as we started thinking about having an episode about men, one of the big drivers was recognizing that our core panel is comprised of five women, and really asking ourselves the question and trying to hold ourselves accountable to say, is there something in the male experience that our core panel can't dive in and deconstruct and help illuminate for our listeners? And so I started doing some work talking to people, and I talked to seven guys. And I really tried to isolate what is it that's unique to the male experience. And I found there was only one thing. And that one thing is the one thing that only men get in Mormonism. And that is priesthood. So today, our topic and what we're excited to dive in and talk about is, what is it like and how do you handle being a priesthood holder during the wardless experience, both before you're public, and then after you've become public about your decision to walk away from Mormonism. So that's going to be our topic and discussion today. I am really excited. And a special shout out and thanks to all the men who spoke with me, shared their stories with me as we prepared this episode. So to start out today, and especially because the three of you are, this is your first time with us on the Wardless Podcast, I would love if each of you could give a broad general introduction. Tell us a little bit about yourself in general, like the family you're raised in. Do you have kids? Do you serve a mission? Were you a fast mover or a slow mover in terms of your faith transition? And where have you landed now? Doug, can we start with you?
Yeah, I was born and raised in the church, convert father. And, you know, we did the whole Mormon thing growing up. I served a mission. Really kind of dove in, wanted to be the most obedient missionary, wanted to do everything I could to, you know, follow the plan. I'm married, have four kids, and, you know, was living the Mormon dream, but at a certain point it started to fall off the rails. So I would describe myself as a slow mover.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've several years into this process, and I attend occasionally.
Your family?
My extended family's not aware. My wife is aware. You know, we're a mixed faith household. She's supportive. you know, it's not always easy, but you know, we've made it work. The kids mostly know. We haven't had explicit conversations with them to say, "Dad's not going because X, Y, and Z." Mm-hmm. They're aware. Some of our closer friends are aware. Extended family, not as much. You know, not making any huge waves. Just kind of slow fading.
All right. Thanks, Doug.
Yep.
Dave, why don't you give us your introduction?
Well, I'm Dave. I was born and raised in a large Mormon family. I served a mission, married in the temple, and served in a lot of callings with the young men, and was an elders quorum president. About 2012, I had some experiences that kind of brought me towards a more nuanced view of the church and particularly the priesthood authority. But continue to be a nuanced attending member for 5 or 6 years until the fall of 2018. My wife and I together decided to step away with our two children away from the church, and have not been back since.
All right, and Miles.
Hey, so I grew up in the heart of Salt Lake City, the oldest of 6 kids, and I was even baptized in the Tabernacle in Temple Square.
Wait. I had no idea that you used to get baptized in the Tabernacle on Temple Square.
Yeah, that was my stake baptismal font. So I thought everyone did that. So grew up in a very believing family and served a mission in Brazil, and then got married, 3 kids, and currently all my kids are teenagers. About 3 years ago, I had serious problems with the race and the priesthood essay. And it basically crashed my shelf, and I was a very quick mover. I was fast and furious. So now I kind of identify as a flaming atheist, and I'm completely out, and my whole family has come out with me.
You know, one thing that you did share previously that I think will come up is you're a bit of a hybrid of Doug and Dave's experiences, where for a while you were in a mixed faith marriage.
Yes.
And how many years was that?
So that was 2 years.
2 years.
And it was extremely difficult.
Yeah.
My wife and I almost got divorced. We came down to sitting across the table with lawyers and everything. And there was a change of heart. And now we're very close.
And that's wonderful.
Yeah.
This is going to be an interesting discussion. Well, thank you for the quick introduction. I want to start moving to talk a bit about priesthood. And I would love if each of you would share, what did priesthood mean to you as a believing member? Doug, would you want to start us off?
Yeah. I mean, the way that I internalized priesthood was really a sense of responsibility and duty. When I was younger, I interpreted it as like, I have to stay worthy, or, you know, I can't level up to the next level, right? I mean, if I'm a deacon, I have to stay worthy, or I'm not going to get leveled up to a teacher. If I'm, you know, teacher.
That idea of level up is really interesting to me. Take me one layer deeper on that.
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, it's very public, right? And this may be one of the things that differentiates it from the female experience in the church, is just that, you know, if I'm not quote unquote worthy to pass the sacrament at 12 years old, I have to tell someone no and then go sit down. And it's a very obvious thing. And so I think that I always felt a sense of really pressure, right? I mean, at 13, I knew like, okay, well, at 14, I'm going to need to be ordained. And then it was 16, I'm going to be ordained a priest. And then it was, oh, gee, I got to be ready to get the Melchizedek priesthood get a BYU ecclesiastical endorsement, and
yeah,
then go on a mission, and then it,
you and know, on and on and on and
yeah,
on.
Yeah, and it really, there's no end to it. I mean, at this point, I'm still looking at that. I still have, okay, you know, I've got another son's baptism coming up, and what do I want to do with that? And pretty quick, we get to ordaining, you know, a son to get the priesthood, mm-hmm. and at some point, there'll be, you know, daughters getting married, and, you know, grandbaby's blessings.
So priesthood to you was a responsibility and a duty,
yeah,
that you had to remain worthy for.
Yeah. And I think when I became a husband and a father, I really internalized that as I'm the provider, right? I need to provide for my kids. I need to provide for their physical needs, for their emotional needs, and for their spiritual needs. And so priesthood really felt like, in some senses, an unattainable standard of, you know, I've got to check all of these right boxes. I've got to be doing everything perfect. And if I don't, I'm going to be left out here kind of high and dry on my own.
Super interesting. All right, a lot that we'll dive into in a minute. Thank you, Doug. Miles, how about you?
Well, I actually believed all the stories about the Old Testament prophets and the miracles they did. I took it literally. And so for me, it was something like it was the power that held the universe together. It was like the light that came from the stars. It was like everything, the whole force of the universe was all held together by a priesthood.
Wow.
And so I think, you know, that because God wielded it, and then basically he was like, yeah, I will share a little bit of that with you. Here's a little teaspoon of priesthood for you, Miles.
And what did that feel like for you as a believing member to hold that teaspoon of that power of God?
I mean, I was kind of scared of, I think I was scared about it because I was like, what if I mess up? For me, it was kind of like the measurement of success in life. Like a man could be measured by, like when he dies, you would measure him if he was successful in his life by the, like, I don't want to say the office of priesthood, but the amount of magnification he did to his priesthood, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was really important. And I felt, I want to echo everything that Doug said about the public side of it. I talked with my wife about that the other day. It's something that's very different from men, from women, because there was this public, at least even if women didn't notice, for the men, we felt it, right? It's a lot of judgment of worthiness from both sides, but probably even more from ourselves. But it was just like this constant thing of, are you worthy? Are you worthy? Are you worthy? And that, I don't feel like that was very healthy for me. For me also, it was like a mechanism for a father and son relationship, meaning like everything around priesthood was an opportunity for a father to teach his son how to be a man. That's how I felt about it.
Say a little bit more.
Well, for example, to me, like scouting and priesthood was mixed. It was just almost the same thing in some ways because we would go as deacons, uh-huh. We'd do all these things. And then on Sunday, we'd go do the other things. Fathers would also be part of that. It was also like we'd go to conference, priesthood conference meeting, and we'd go out to eat afterwards and kind of have these one-on-one moments and talk about how to be a man, how to be righteous, how to be a good family provider, all, you know, your profession. Like it all went into like priesthood.
So what I'm hearing is that your experiences with the priesthood were also where, and please correct me if I'm not capturing this correctly, it's where you saw the type of man that you were supposed to be and become.
Yeah.
And be trained in how to be the right type of man.
Yep. For me, that was what priesthood was.
Fascinating. All right. And lastly, for you, Dave, what did priesthood mean to you as a believing member?
So I think a lot of the same things that Doug and Miles have already kind of talked about, but this idea that as a priesthood holder, we held the authority of God. And even more for me as a believing member, it was even more than how to become a man. It was how to become a God. And I really held this belief that someday I was going to be owning my own world. And wow. And that if I did all the things right, that I would become a God. And so everything became about learning to use that authority that was given. And then because I work so much with the young men, teaching them how to use that authority of God. But on the flip side of that, I saw so often that young men would come up to that time when it was time to level up, to move.
I love that term level up that Doug used, don't you?
Yeah. to move from specifically from the time when they were finishing being a deacon and moving into the teachers, that there was a lot of potential for shame that was there. That, you know, if this young man was doing something that was making him unworthy, there was shame that was there if he was not going to be allowed to pass the sacrament for a while. And it broke my heart for me as their youth leader to see them in pain that way and for them to not be able to progress.
It really makes sense when you talk about priesthood is about becoming a god. It sounds like to you it meant a very great thing.
Yeah.
And here these young men were being held back from it. That's a really interesting sort of tug in different directions.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to add about what priesthood meant to you?
I think Doug and Miles have covered it really pretty well, especially the idea about relationship with dad. I saw my dad modeling what service in the church should be, modeling what priesthood, being what a priesthood man should be. And there was both positive and negative things with that. You know, I saw him going and ministering, and I saw him going and caring for others, but I also saw him stepping away from his family to do that. And especially being from a large family, some of my siblings felt that a lot more than I did, but you know, we often saw dad leave to go and care for others. And sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it was hard.
Mm-hmm. I can relate to that. Yeah. Well, thanks for the baseline on your experiences with a priesthood as a believing person. Let's start talking about your wardless experience. One of the things I noticed as I conducted my interviews to learn about the wardless experience of a priesthood holder, I realized there's these two different phases. Phase one is before you're public. It's when you're private about any sort of change in belief and change in faith. And then phase two is once people know, right? And I'm not just saying like a spouse, but people in the ward, church members, family members know about your change in faith. But so let's talk about the former first. What was it like for you using the priesthood once you no longer believed, but before you were public about leaving? Anyone want to kick us off here?
I could start.
Go for it, Dave.
The priesthood was a really big part of my testimony. It really held me to the church even for a long time when I began to not believe. This idea that the church, and specifically the prophet, held the priesthood keys, mm-hmm. held me to the church, even as I wasn't sure about whether the church was true or not true. I kept coming back because I felt like the church held the priesthood authority of God. This is where the priesthood keys were. About 6 years ago, I was released from a calling that I felt was a direct calling from God by a bishop. And that's really kind of was one of the first times that I began to feel like I was called by God. I wasn't called by a man. And here this man is telling me, you're going to be released from this calling and you're going to do something else. And it really felt like a very much an administrative move rather than a direction from God.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, you can't release me. Like, you don't have the authority to release me. How can you release me?
Interesting.
And so at that point I said, well, gosh, obviously this guy doesn't have the priesthood. Maybe let's move to a ward that does. And so I did the only way I knew how to go find somebody else who had authority. And we picked up our family and moved to another town.
You literally moved towns.
We moved towns.
Wow.
Now, there were lots of other reasons for moving. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, just totally out of
the blue.
But
it was part of the decision.
But it was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Interesting.
And I moved to a ward that I found had a better priesthood authority.
I was about to say, did you find that priesthood authority in that ward?
I
did.
I found it there.
Okay.
But it was sort of that first fracture for me, or one of the first fractures for me in realizing that, yeah, perhaps this man doesn't have the mm-hmm. authority of God. Maybe there's some piece to that.
So at some point after you moved into this new ward, you got to the point where you no longer believed as you had before. What was it like for you being called on to use your priesthood in that period where your faith had crumbled, mm-hmm. but before you walked away?
I think that even though I didn't believe that the priesthood was really truly the authority of God anymore, I still felt like it was a good method for teaching young men responsibility.
That a little bit.
One of the things that the priesthood did is it allowed young men to get gradually more and more responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so I just decided I'm going to use that, and we'll use the mechanisms that are here to make good people. And I just sort of compartmentalized the shame and the guilt, the idea that you had to be worthy in order to use it. And I tried to just kind of put that part out of my brain and say, this is a great method for teaching young people, or for specifically boys. And also, you know, sort of my cognitive dissonance, I had to kind of put aside this idea that we weren't doing this for the girls as well in the same way.
Yeah.
And I think part of my will, my need to stay in the church, kind of caused me to section that away and stick it off on another shelf.
That hadn't broken. Yeah. Right. Well, I hear this theme from you that something that this passion I hear about you is you are passionate about working with youth.
Yeah.
And so, you know, priesthood became a tool for you to do something that you were passionate about outside the construct of the gospel even.
Yeah.
And that you figured out how to use it in a way that, yes, there was some cognitive dissonance and yes, I do some compartmentalizing, but you could make it work.
Yeah.
How did that ability to make it work hold up? Were you able to stay that way until the day you walked out the door?
Yeah, I think I really was. I think I really was able to just continue to work with young men. I participated fully.
Yeah.
I stood in the circle for ordinations, and that sort of thing. I baptized my son, a few months before we left the church.
And so if you didn't believe in the authority, how did you view that experience?
It was just a cultural thing. It was very much at that point, he wanted to be baptized. And I felt like, hey, this is part of the culture that we're here. We're in the culture until we leave. We had already I was ready to go by that point, but I felt like, hey, it's part of the culture and we're in until we're not in.
You know, Dave, your story is so fascinating to me because you almost had a crisis of faith because of something dealing with priesthood. And then you found this way to reengage with priesthood, and you found a ward where you felt like you found that authority again. But then once your faith did eventually crumble, priesthood became a tool to continue to relate and help build great young people. Like, it's so interesting how this thread of priesthood has taken on so many different colors, right? As it's gone through your story, but it's definitely present and it's definitely a big part of your experience and your story.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that.
So Miles, let's jump over to you. I would love to understand, so for your experience, once you found your faith crumbling, what was it like to interact with the priesthood and specifically to use your priesthood?
The interesting thing for me is that I was a really fast mover. When I lost my faith, there was not much time before I pretty much told everybody. But one thing that, as I was losing my faith, I had been going through some serious chronic pain, for 20 years. I got really, really sick. And when it all came down to it, as I was really, really terribly sick with an undiagnosed, illness, I got a blessing from my father. And I leaned on that blessing for probably like 3 years as I kept crescendoing into just the most devastating sickness.
Yeah.
And as I was losing my faith, I still wanted to hold on. And the main reason I wanted to hold on because I wanted my dad's blessing to be real. And I got many offers of other people saying, we'll give you a blessing. I was like, no, I have my dad's blessing. There's no other blessing that can top it. And I held on to that until the last moment when I realized I didn't believe in prophets anymore. And then if I didn't believe in prophets, I didn't believe in priesthood. And then I kind of had to let it all go, but it was really hard to let go.
So sounds like that was one of the last things.
Yeah.
It was the thing.
I remember just holding on to that for dear life, my dad's blessing.
What do you mean by held on to that blessing?
It was just such a precious thing to me.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that my dad would use his priesthood power to bless me, you know, like that, to me, that was so beautiful because I know how much my dad loves me and it's the purest of love, most powerful thing you could have, right? And he's such a good person. Like if your power of priesthood was equal to your worthiness,
yeah,
then it was powerful, right?
And the fact that he's giving it to you, he's sharing that power with you.
Yeah, it makes me cry to think about it even right now.
Yeah, I can tell it's a very powerful part of your experience, and I could see why that was one of the last things that you had to figure out how to let go of.
Yeah, it was hard.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that for us, Miles. Doug, let's move on to you. What was it like in that time before you went public, being asked to use your priesthood?
Quite honestly, a lot of avoidance. I would say I avoided being put in a situation at all costs because I was very uncomfortable with it. It felt fake for me to, you know, put my hands on someone's head and say something if I didn't believe it. And I think very early on, there's a common phrase that you hear in priesthood blessings in the church, I feel like, that kind of makes the blessing conditional upon the faith of the person and the faith of the person giving
all these
the blessing.
Blessings are predicated upon your obedience or your faith in God.
And then there's a caveat. It says, and the will of our Father in heaven, right? Yeah. So like, I felt really uneasy giving blessings without putting that in, because I knew I didn't have the ironclad faith to make this thing happen, right? And you know, if it's God's will that it doesn't go the right way, well then, you know, God had a different plan, right? Where it was especially challenging for me, you know, in the very, very beginning before my wife knew, if she needed a blessing and she would ask, I would gladly give one. Once she knew, it became harder because I knew that she was aware that I didn't believe. And the question is, does that cheapen the blessing from her perspective, right? If she needs a blessing, does she want it from somebody who really believes, who, you know, is really kind of channeling their priesthood authority, or does she want it from somebody who's just going through the motions and putting his hands on?
How did you handle that situation?
Trial and error. Once she became aware, I think she was uncomfortable asking because she knew I was uncomfortable doing it. But then I was uncomfortable with her feeling like she couldn't get the, you know, the blessings of the priesthood when she felt like she needed it. While we were living abroad, she had a pretty significant health issue that came up, and, you know, we're dealing with culture shock and language barriers and the whole nine yards. And it was pretty obvious that she needed a blessing, and I understood that. I wanted her to get one, and I wanted it to be meaningful to her. So we actually had some friends come over and do it, and I actually told them that I didn't feel like I was in a place to do it. Now, I think they interpreted that as me being too emotional and too close to the situation, not necessarily in terms of faith.
It's interesting because I thought immediately that they would have interpreted that as worthiness.
Yeah, I mean, I actually asked them, even though, I mean, I was very much kind of right in the middle of the deconstruction phase of my faith crisis. I actually asked them for a blessing as well. And when I sit back and look at it, I think that was partially to try to communicate, hey, look, I'm struggling with this too. I think it was partially also as a sign of solidarity for my wife. You know, it was incredibly scary. It was it was hard knowing that because I'd been open and honest with her, that I felt like that fact made it so that I couldn't completely satisfy what she was needing at that point.
Am I hearing that you still felt a responsibility to use your phrase from earlier, provide for her spiritually?
Yes.
Or provide for her spiritual need.
Yes, yes. She clearly had a need.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the time or place to have a debate about whether or not priesthood blessings work and whether, you know,
whether the priesthood's real.
Whether the priesthood is real or any of that. I knew that she needed something to, you know, to give her a sense of peace and a sense of comfort. But I felt like the fact that she knew where I was at meant that I couldn't give that to her. So we, you know, we enlisted the help of friends, and, you know, they did a great job.
And I just sit here and I'm envisioning in my head, Doug, foreign country, health issue, scared and alone, you know, and I see a beautiful compassion to the way that even in your moment of deconstruction, that you were still caring for your wife's spiritual needs. And I think there's a beauty in that.
I mean, initially, it was hard feeling like I was not fulfilling my responsibility and having to have someone else come into the home to do it. I've made peace with that feeling now. I think now the hardest thing for me is knowing that other people will perceive it as, you know, a failure to provide, when in fact I am still providing by respecting her need and making sure that somebody is coming in to take care of it.
We will get to that perception of failure to provide, because I think that's a really critical piece that would cut across almost all of the stories.
Well, I think it's interesting, Oliver, that like there's no guide, with the exception of the Wordless podcast.
Oh, great plug, Dave. Great plug.
There is no guide on the exit strategy. And so we've all just kind of bumbled along and tried to figure out, well, what do we do when our family member needs a blessing? What do we do when we need to give this thing? Because everything else that we do in the church, there's a handbook, mm-hmm. there's an instruction manual.
Especially everything priesthood.
And there's an example. And yeah. Most of us have never really had any of the, we haven't really seen anyone. And if we have seen someone leave, it may have been in a blazing ball of fire.
The people who are very public, it's often very messy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I wanted to point out, especially with you, Doug, is I definitely don't want any listeners, anyone to think that there's a right or a wrong way to handle these, you know, and the hope that we have with Wordless is that by sharing various different stories, folks can relate to different pieces and piece together. This is what makes sense for my path, right? Because like you said, Dave, there is no guide. So thank you for sharing that with us. All right. I want to ask a question about how you viewed priesthood. We talked at the top about what priesthood meant to you as a believing member. I'm curious, as your faith deconstructed, what was it like looking at priesthood during that time? Or what was it like looking back at how you used to believe in priesthood as a believing member on the other side as a non-believing member? Miles, do you want to jump in with us?
Yeah, I'll just be brief. But for me, after I stopped believing, I looked back at priesthood and I saw it as a kind of like a controlling factor in my life that kind of made me do a lot of things I might not have done, like going on a mission. Mm-hmm. I felt a lot of guilt in my teenage years. I also spent a lot of time away from my family while my wife was going through really hard times with my kids because I was in the bishopric. I was sitting on the stand in sacrament meeting and my family's not there because she can't get to church because it's too hard.
Yeah.
And so when I look back, I've had a lot of, I was angry because I felt like there were things stolen from me.
Yeah.
Because of that.
That's really interesting. What about you, Doug?
I said earlier that before my concept of it was kind of duty, responsibility, and some element of pressure, I think I felt trapped, quite honestly. I mean, I'm the slow mover, right? I'm wanting to do the slow fade, wanting to kind of ease into the background. You know, there's a very public, kind of clear timeline for when things happen. And there's a certain aspect of, well, I can't leave now because I won't be able to kind of just fade off into the ether. It's going to be a very visible thing. I'm actually facing that right now. My son turns 8 in August. And I'm more public now than I was when my daughters turned 8. At the time, I had kind of conflicting feelings about doing their baptisms, but I did it, you know, similar to what Dave had said, that it's kind of a cultural thing. It's a rite of passage. But, you know, now enough people know, my bishop knows, and he's pulled me aside and said, okay, well, the handbook will let you do the baptism, but not the confirmation. And the stake policy is that the baptism has to be on a clearly defined day, you know, the certain day. And so it's very public. And, you know, so now I kind of have this question of, do I do it or don't I do it? And there's not really, I'm very much trapped. I don't get to do it on my own timeline. I'm doing it based on the timeline set by, you know, the church's standard ordinance schedule and the stake baptism schedule. And, you know, I have a whole bunch of other people who are saying, no, this is when it has to be exercised. And I don't really get to make some of those decisions myself.
How does it make you feel to be put in that situation?
It's tough. quite honestly, there's a certain amount of resentment. You know, my parents and siblings don't know.
Yeah.
My parents have already told me that they booked their flights to come up for the baptism because the baptism is scheduled.
Yeah.
Right? So they're just assuming that there will be a baptism and that I'll be the one doing it.
Yeah.
So it's forcing a conversation that I've been putting off for close to 10 years now. So it's probably good, right? You know, I mean, at a certain point, maybe I need some nudges in the right direction. I just wish that I got to do some of these things on my time, on my terms, kind of in the circumstances that feel good to me, as opposed to like, well, no, that's what the calendar says. And, you know, the stake doesn't do smaller private baptisms. So, you know, whoever from my ward happens to turn up for that stake baptism, well, if they're paying attention, they'll at least notice that I'm not doing the confirmation. And I guess depending on what I decide to do with the baptism, they may or may not notice that. But
what I'm hearing a lot of, you use the word resentment at something that is pushing you not to do this the way that you want to do it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden this external expectation is now forcing you to have to change that. And that's frustrating.
Yeah.
So I went through an almost identical experience last year with my son and ended up being this sort of the thing that actually pushed us out of activity in the church. And we had decided that we were having some trouble and we weren't quite sure that we'd want to stay. And I went to the bishop and asked, well, can we do a smaller private, maybe not in the church? Let's go to a river or to a lake. And we were told no, that it can't be. And it was to the point that like, okay, now I just want to leave right now. And we approached my son and said, you know, how would you feel about us postponing your baptism for a few months while we kind of process and consider this? And it broke his heart. He was really saddened by it. And so I just decided, you know what? I'll just baptize you in the church. That's fine. We'll go along. We'll play the game. In the back of my head, I'm saying, this is it. I'm done.
It was the straw.
It was the straw. Yeah.
Again, something with priesthood was the straw. Yeah. How did that feel in that moment when you realized that this is it?
I was mad.
Really?
I was really mad because I had made it work for a long time. And I felt like I could continue to just kind of put these pieces together and sort of hold together a nuanced view and a new order Mormon and live that life.
What made you want to keep that nuanced view together?
Because I loved my community. I still love my ward. I love the people I went to church with and that community that I had. And I was scared to deconstruct that because I wasn't sure I could find it anywhere else. And still, you know, this many months out, I still struggle to find that community.
Yeah. So Dave, I would love to quickly get your take on that question of what did that feel like as your faith deconstructed to look back on how you viewed priesthood as a believing member?
I think one of the significant pieces for me was to think about sort of how, and actually something I wrote in my journal kind of through that process was, I'm concerned about the theological dominoes that fall if the prophet and apostles were so blatantly wrong on such an important issue. You know, specifically talking about, I believe about that time period, I was thinking about the November 5th policy. And like, I had this worldview that the prophets and apostles held not only the power and authority of God, but also held, I don't know, conversations with God. And so when I began to come to a point where I didn't believe those things, I felt like I was lied to. I felt like I was betrayed, and it was really frustrating.
It's interesting to hear you say those three things: betrayed, frustrated, and lied to. But when I think about that in connection with what you said earlier, that priesthood was the power to become a god. You know, for I don't know what becoming a god meant for you. Was it about the power? Was it about the perfection? Was it about all of it, you know, wrapped up? But for all of a sudden this to become something that is now giving you so much hurt.
Yeah.
Like that word betrayal really, really, I don't know, when you said it, it really rang out to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So listeners, we're going to do something a little different with this episode. Because the conversation's already been so long and goes on for a bit more, we decided to split it into two episodes. So come back next week and we'll continue with Dave, Miles, and Doug as they continue to share their stories about their experiences as a priesthood holder going through the wordless experience. As always, we would love any thoughts that you have to share about this episode, different perspectives or different experiences, especially relating to using priesthood and being called on as a priesthood holder during your private phase of your wordless experience. Join us on our Facebook group, the Wordless Podcast Group, or email us at wordlesspodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Instagram, all the social medias. So come back next week and hear the conclusion of the conversation.
You've been listening to Wordless, a post-Mormon field guide. For more information and for the show notes for this episode, visit wordlesspodcast.com. If you have a question you'd like us to answer on the podcast, a topic you'd like us to consider, or if you think you might have a unique perspective to add to an upcoming episode, we'd love to hear from you. And if you found this episode helpful, please consider leaving us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. But the most helpful thing you can do is share this episode with someone you know. So please share the love and pass on our links. Thanks again for listening. We hope it makes you feel a little less wordless.